This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in this week for Terry Gross. It's hard to believe it, but it's been 9 years since Jerry Seinfeld made the last episode of his hit TV series. At 53, Seinfeld is now married, has 3 children, and has returned to stand-up comedy. But for much of the last 4 years, he's worked to bring his unique brand of humor to a new medium. Seinfeld is a writer, producer, and co-star with Renee Zellweger of B-Movie, an animated feature about a bee who learns about life outside the hive and eventually sues humanity for stealing honey. In this scene, Seinfeld, as Barry B. Benson, is talking to his parents, played by Barry Levinson and Kathy Bates, about whether he wants to follow his dad's career path and spend his life stirring honey.
Dad, do you ever get bored doing the same job every day?
Son, let me tell you something about stirring. You grab that stick and you just move it around and you stir it around. You get yourself into a rhythm. It's a beautiful thing.
You know, Dad, the more I think about it, maybe the honey field just isn't right for me.
And you were thinking of what? Making balloon animals? That's a bad job for a guy with a stinger.
Well, no.
Get it? Your son's not sure he wants to go into honey.
Oh, Barry, you are so funny sometimes.
I'm not trying to be funny.
You're not funny. You're going into honey. Our son, the stirrer.
You're going to be a stirrer?
No one's listening to me.
Wait till you see the sticks I have for you.
I can say anything I want right now. I'm going to get an ant tattoo.
Let's open some fresh honey and celebrate.
Maybe I'll pierce my thorax.
To honey.
Shave my antenna.
Honey.
Check up with a grasshopper. Get a gold tooth. And start calling everybody dog.
I spoke to Jerry Seinfeld when he was in Philadelphia recently. Well, Jerry Seinfeld, welcome back to Fresh Air. You've spent years fine-tuning your stand-up material, and I know you work it meticulously. How is writing a screenplay different?
The trouble with it is you have this story, which is such a nuisance. You know, in stand-up, you just tell the funny part. But in a movie, the audience demands that you tell them some sort of story that makes sense. And this was a tremendous handicap for me because it frankly doesn't interest me that much.
The story.
Yeah. Right. But you do have to have one. And so and it has to work. And the funny thing I found is when the story works, the jokes work better. So I had to work on the jokes came easily, but figuring out the story of what happens to this bee and how he gets involved with the humans and how everything goes wrong and how to make it all come out right in the end and make it funny all the way really taxed my feeble little brain.
you have a context of a story as opposed to a stand-up act where you're grabbing that audience and taking them where you want them to go.
Yeah, nobody seems to care that you're jumping to a different subject every 90 seconds.
Right.
That's why I prefer stand-up.
Now, I read that Steven Spielberg was kind of a sounding board here. What kind mm-hmm. of advice did he give you?
I'll tell you, he gave me some great advice, which I was ashamed to have to receive. The hardest part of telling the story is coming up with the end of the story that it's satisfying. You know, that after you've invested in these characters and kind of watched them go through this journey, that you feel good about where it all wound up. And at some point, I guess we were three-quarters of the way through making the thing, and I asked him to come in and look at it, and he watched it, and he said, you know, the last quarter of the movie, what happened to the silliness? What happened to all the fun and the silliness? And I said, well, I thought the ending should just be exciting and, you know, like the hero comes to save the day. He says, no, not in this movie. He says, you start off having all this fun and acting so goofy and silly, you have to maintain that all the way to the end. And, you know, as a comedian, it was pretty embarrassing to have to be told that by a guy who's really not known for being that funny.
Jerry, you got to be funny here.
Yeah, Jerry, you should be funny here in this part of it. So that was actually a great piece of advice that he gave us. It was like that little, you know, you get close to something that you work on for a long time and you can't see what's wrong with it. And that was like a big key that kind of, keep it silly.
You know, it's interesting that when you do stand-up, I mean, that's nothing is more autonomous than the stand-up comedian. It's his act, and the mm-hmm. feedback is immediate. I mean, you go
right.
in, you bomb, whatever, you kill.
Maybe doing stand-up alone by yourself could be more autonomous.
Possibly. And the feedback would be even more immediate. Maybe.
Right, that's right.
But, you know, a movie takes years. It's begins with endless meetings. Mm-hmm. There's endless editing. How did you adjust to the pace of it?
I didn't adjust very well, to be honest with you. It kind of goes against my natural instinct, which is I want to hear tonight if this is any funny or not. You have test screenings, and it was just like being strapped down for 4 years. You know, I know a lot of other comedy writers and comedians that would look at me and they would say, "You're still working on that movie?"
Right.
And I go, "Yeah, we're still going." I mean, 4 years, it's like I know people that wrote movies, got them produced, edited, released, went on to other movies.
We're speaking with Jerry Seinfeld. He is the producer and star of the new animated movie, B-Movie. I wanted to talk a little bit about your stand-up, which has, you know, been your core for years. And I wanted to play a clip. And this is not you at a club. It's actually a clip from an appearance on Letterman. And I got it from the documentary you did, Comedian. Uh-huh. And the context here is this is after the show has been off the air for a while, and you're coming back, and it's a TV appearance. I don't know if you remember this. Let's listen.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I totally appreciate what you're saying. I do, but the question is this. What have I been doing? Everybody says to me, "Hey, you don't do the show anymore. What do you do?" I'll tell you what I do. Nothing. Yeah, I know what you're thinking. That sounds pretty good. You're thinking, I might like to do nothing myself. Well, let me tell you, doing nothing is not as easy as it looks. You have to be careful. Because the idea of doing anything, which could easily lead to doing something, that would cut into your nothing, and that would force me to have to drop everything.
And that's Jerry Seinfeld, our guest from an appearance on the David Letterman show many years ago. You know what I love about that clip is that you got four or five really good laughs out of what, one joke?
Nothing.
No, hardly a joke. I mean, and it shows all those years in clubs. You've just got the pacing and the punch exactly where you want it.
Thank you.
And I mean, I know you spent all those years. You made your first appearance on The Tonight Show in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
And through the 80s, you're building a reputation as a stand-up, at a time when there are a lot of other comedians that are out there that are maybe getting more attention by being outrageous or profane or kind of using props or crazy characters. And I wondered, you know, kind of gave them an identity and a hook. Did you ever try that stuff, or were you ever tempted to try it?
No, I never was. And I always felt like I was very much a hookless comedian, and I would always be hookless. And that, I thought, maybe that's my hook, you know, that I just don't have anything that you latch on to as he's the guy who does this or looks like this. And but it wouldn't have felt right anyway. I mean that was kind of the joke about the show, was that it was about nothing. But what it really was about was the way we executed it. And it's the same thing as what my stand-up is about. It's the same thing as what that joke was about. What is that joke? It's taking the word nothing, something, everything, and anything, and assembling it into a thought that makes sense. And so that's really what I like to do. I'm more into the execution than I am anything other aspect of it. I mean, I don't even care about being famous or being, you know, I just enjoy the doing of the thing.
Well, you know, in the documentary Comedian, which is, you know, for those who haven't seen it, it's you going back to stand-up after having done the show and kind of getting back into it. And there's this moment in it that I really love where you've sort of built the act up toward it. You've now got a good 50 minutes, and you do an appearance, I think, at a club in Washington, D.C., and it seems to have gone pretty well. But after it, you're not satisfied, and you're saying, God, it's just so hard to really – feel comfortable, and you're kind of bemoaning whether you really hit it as you're packing your stuff and getting into your private jet, or what looks like your private jet.
Yeah.
And so what's fascinating is we have you who have all that money and success that insist on subjecting yourself to this ego-battering process of getting back in live clubs.
Mm-hmm.
You always want to do that. Why?
You know, it's just that feeling of not cheating. that is the, I think, the best feeling in life. I didn't cheat at that. And stand-up is the only thing that I knew that I could be sure that I, if I was doing it and audiences were responding well, that I wasn't cheating. Because there is no way to cheat in stand-up. It's the nakedest, purest thing in the world. But I could have gone into a movie. Someone would say, we have a great idea for a movie for you. And they could have put me in a movie and promoted the movie. And the movie did this. And I would never know, was that any good or not?
Right.
You know, say, well, the director didn't handle you right. Or it wasn't promoted the way it should have been. There's always a million excuses. There's no excuses in stand-up. So after all of that experience of Hollywood and television and everything that the show did, I just wanted to get back to something that I knew what was right and wrong and what was black and white. And it's a very black and white world. And that was a calming to me. And that was – it just would make me feel – I just never wanted to feel like I was skating on a reputation or, you know.
And you can't skate on a reputation at a live club.
No, absolutely not.
Even if you're Jerry Seinfeld.
Even if you're Jerry Seinfeld. Maybe a couple of minutes. They may give you 3 or 4 free minutes at the top. But after a while, no one laughs at a reputation. It's not funny.
And did you get where you wanted to be? Did you get comfortable?
I did finally. It took about 4 or 5 years of working. And I've lost it a little bit now doing the movie, and I'm going to go back. But it's kind of a tennis game. A stand-up act is like a tennis game. And even if you're good, you got to keep playing if you want to keep that game at a certain point.
And you're sure you want to keep playing?
I love the simplicity of it. I love the purity of it. It's just... This is what the – I mean, all this work that we went into the movie – I mean, to make an animated movie, the infrastructure of DreamWorks is $1 billion. That's what it costs just to have the machines to make one of these things. And then the years of work – and what is it all for? It's so that when we put it in front of the audience, you hear a laugh.
Same thing as standing up and telling a joke, right?
Same thing. So, you know, I like it's the difference between, you know – You say you like the water. Well, you can be the captain of a ship or you can surf.
Right.
And stand-up's like surfing. You're just right there with it.
Well, since you were last on Fresh Air, you did this TV series, which kind of took off.
Right.
It's sort of a measure of its cultural reach. You know, my wife had a career change this year, and she had about 6 weeks between her old job and when she began her new life as a resident in psychiatry, which was in June and July. And I began referring to this time, which she'd look forward to so much, as her Summer of George, which, for folks who may not recall, was the Seinfeld episode where George Costanza has a summer off and he buys an easy chair with a built-in refrigerator.
Right.
And what's funny about it is that, you know, when I kind of came up with that phrase, everybody in my family laughed and talked about it. She would talk about her friends. They all knew exactly what we were talking about.
Right.
And in a way, those... That series, which you haven't made a new episode in 9 years now, mm-hmm. but it's all over television, mm-hmm. is sort of this book of life. I mean, people use moments and lines from that series to describe what's going on in their lives. You're aware of this phenomenon.
I am, but I don't get it. I mean, it mystifies me as much as you, and I'm only happy that it's doing something for somebody.
That doesn't mystify me because you're capturing stuff that we all kind of recognize.
Right, but isn't every... Why is it different in other comedy shows? Why can't you name other comedy shows? Somebody, you know, Larry David said to me the other day that this was the first show where people would say, well, that's a Seinfeld episode about something that I had a day today that sounds like a Seinfeld episode. That our show was for some reason lent people to think like that about their own lives. Because I guess maybe one of the reasons is we stayed so close to the – people's real lives. We tried to anyway, as much as we could, aside from, you know, hitting golf balls into the blowhole of a whale.
Right.
And maybe that's why people can analogize to it or from it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I read a piece about you when you were doing stand-up, like maybe 89, when you were pitching the show to NBC, and you had made quite a reputation in the stand-up act and were just about to do a series. And there had... Then the LA Times actually had a full-time comedy writer who did a review of a show you did and was pretty critical.
Lawrence Christian.
That's the one.
Lawrence Christian, yeah.
And the criticism seemed to be Seinfeld, yeah, he's a pro, his sets are funny, but there's sort of not enough substance? There's not enough of a message.
Yeah.
And how ironic that, like, now all these years later, this is it's your stuff that kind of evokes the score of life.
Right. Yeah, that guy didn't like me. The reason he didn't like me, and I did not begrudge him for not liking me, is because I had a publicist at the time that put a sign in front of the theater that said, and I didn't know anything about this. He said, "Jerry Seinfeld, master of observational comedy," and that's like, well, the show ends right there. You put that in front of your theater, no one's gonna like you. You know, it's like, and now, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the funniest man in the world. That's instant death. We'll follow that.
I mean, don't people hype all kinds of stuff? I mean, the audience loved the show, didn't they?
As we said, my thing, it's a hookless act. It's a humble act, hopefully. You know, it's really about little things that are hopefully well observed. So, and so the guy, you know, so he just lit into me. It was an interesting moment because, the series was just beginning and then this horrible thing appears in the paper and everybody thought, oh, my God, is NBC going to get cold feet now and they're going to bail out on the series? But a lot of times there's always this thing with, well, he's no Richard Pryor, you know. And I always, you know, would apologize for not being raised by prostitutes in a whorehouse. It was just there was just very little I could do about it, and I try to overcome it as best I can.
How did you know when it was time for the show to end?
If from my stage act, the stage act, you know, if I had been doing comedy, let's see, about 23 years at that time. And you start to know on stage when to get off. There's just this feeling that you develop from years and years of doing it. You just feel that we're getting, everyone's really having a good time, and I think in another few minutes this is going to start to get old. Good night, everybody. And everyone's happy. And I'm sure you've had the experience, everyone's had the experience of going to a movie that you love, but for some reason they just make it 15 minutes longer than it really needed to be. And the change in your feeling about the movie because of that little 15 minutes, and they may not even be a bad 15 minutes. It's just proportions. You know, I guess it's a function of art and an economy. That economy is essential to all good art. And I thought, even though we had done a lot, 9 years, 180 episodes, I thought we can't do one too many or it's going to taint the whole thing. So it was more the energy I felt around the show itself.
That's what's interesting because on stage you've got that you have
right.
that sense from the audience that you've honed over the years.
Right. It was in the office. It was in the office of the show. The writers would come in and the way they would look at me and what they would say. So I had a thought that maybe Kramer would become friends with a penguin or something, you know, and I would hear it in their voice. They're not as excited. This is getting old. And I thought, well, if it's happening here, the audience is next.
Right.
And, you know, I had a meeting with Jack Welch, and he showed me these. It was a hilarious meeting where he
was the chairman of
– the chairman of GE at the time, and they owned NBC. And he had these charts of the ratings and the demographics of the show. And every chart showed the numbers going up. He said, "You have improved your audience from the eighth season to the ninth. The ninth is stronger than the eighth." So it was all backwards. You know, usually you go in there, you try and tell them why you deserve more money and why the show should be kept on. And it was everything was backwards. I'm telling him, no, we shouldn't go anymore. He says, no, you should. I'll give you a raise. I'll give you more money. You know, I said, I don't want money. I want the audience to have this thing. It was kind of like, and I don't mean to compare myself in any way, shape, or form to the Beatles, but when the Beatles ended, it was so sudden, and it made what they did somehow more valuable.
Right.
Because it just suddenly was over, and that's it. That's the complete set. You know, 9 years, 12 albums, whatever it is, that's it. So I kind of took from that, I want to try and do that.
You know, it's funny. I can't help but think of the episode in the series when George Costanza adopts this posture and in a meeting gets one funny line that cracks off a line that breaks the room up and he says,
right.
That's it. I'm done. I'm out of here.
That's where the idea came from.
Yeah. You know, the series was about these four adults single adults in New York living kind of very self-absorbed lives. You now have three kids. Mm-hmm. You have a whole family life. Mm-hmm. Are we going to see a whole new kind of material out of you? You
mean I do talk about my kids and my wife a lot more. I say this in my act, is I don't talk with single guys. I'm not interested in them or their lives. That if you don't have a wife, we really have nothing to talk about. And they say, well, the guys will say, well, I have a girlfriend. I go, well, that's wiffle ball, my friend. You know, you're playing paintball war and I'm in Iraq with real guns.
It's the real thing.
Yeah.
Well, Jerry Seinfeld, I wish we had more time, but thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Jerry Seinfeld is writer, producer, and co-star with Renee Zellweger of the new animated feature, B-Movie. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.